This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCullum. The recent recession brought on many problems, and among them, it created a tough job market for new college graduates to break into. Given the high unemployment rates, a group of researchers wanted to find out what exactly employers were looking for in an employee. Among the many factors they studied, the researchers found that college graduates with internship experience had a much greater chance at getting a job interview in their field. Joining me today to talk about the research is one of the co-authors of these series of research papers, John Nunley. He's a UW La Crosse Assistant Professor of Economics. So, John, I'm wondering if you can talk about why it is that you got together with, I understand, one of your former students and researchers at other universities to really focus in on that and better understand the job market for college graduates.
I think the starting point for the research was that we were interested in sort of the experience that college graduates had been dealt, you know. So they graduated at a really bad time. Obviously, most people have focused on unemployment, high rates of unemployment, as well as the lengthy unemployment spells. But there's really a second part of that that is, for the most part, gone unnoticed, and that is underemployment. So that's taking a job that's below your skill level. So you graduate with a bachelor's degree and you end up working at a job that was traditionally performed by someone with just a high school degree, such as working in a retail shop. So that was the basic idea, is we wanted to see how graduating and becoming unemployed, graduating and becoming underemployed, how that affected your second job. So we weren't really examining the first job. We were looking at, you got your first job. Was it a good job? Was it a bad job? And how did that affect your next job, the prospects for getting your second job?
The method of the study I find is fascinating, and it seems incredibly time-consuming.
I would have to go back and look, but I think we planned the experiment for probably around 6 to 9 months. And that consisted of looking at resumes online, talking to career services. Two of the co-authors, Adam Pugh and Nicholas Romero, were both graduating at that same time, and they were working on their resumes. So that was probably the first thing, was what do people put on their resumes? How do we make these look realistic to employers? And then thinking about the questions we wanted to ask. So we wanted to make sure that we could study the unemployment and the underemployment that I spoke about a moment ago, but also capture, do particular majors matter? Does internship experience matter? Does race, does gender, do those things affect the probability of getting an interview? I could talk a little bit about how we come up with ways to signal those things. Mm-hmm. So, for example, identifying racial differential treatment by race or gender, we would use how the name sounds. So we would identify very racially distinct names, such as Deshaun Jefferson versus, you know, Cody Kelly or something like that. I forget the exact names that we use. They're in the papers. But like I said, the internships were done by sort of looking at how other people put internship experience on their resume, and we sort of copied that approach and would randomly. And this is the really important thing about the experiment, is the random assignment of these characteristics. So we kind of think about it like we start with a blank piece of paper. We have a computer algorithm that was written that would randomly generate all these attributes and complete this resume for us. We would send four of those resumes to each employer, and the outcome of interest was whether they got a callback or an interview request from that employer.
And you sent these out to 2,000 different job openings online?
A little bit more, actually, 2,200 or so.
Wow. And most of these jobs that these, I don't know if we want to call them fake applicants.
They're fake.
Okay. What they were applying for was within the banking, finance, insurance, management, marketing, and sales industry. So basically business.
Yes, we chose that for a reason. We wanted to look at the mismatch in qualifications. Does a business degree help you get a business job over, say, something like history or English?
Essentially, you found that it was successful if one of the fake applicants got a callback for a job interview or an email response,
right.
I guess.
That's too. Right. That's right. Huh.
So let's start breaking down maybe some of the different findings.
Okay.
In the long run,
how much of a difference does a major make when it comes to someone applying for a business job?
This finding is a little nuanced. So you got to, the important thing to keep in mind is that our fake applicants completed their degrees in May 2010, and they were applying for jobs from January 2013 through the end of July 2013. But we found really no relationship between the major and getting an interview. It didn't matter at all if you had a finance degree versus an English degree, at least statistically. We detected no differences. Now, that's not to say that there's not an immediate effect. We've contemplated doing another study, but as we discussed, it's very time-consuming to do these, and so we wonder if it's worth the investment. But we didn't look at your initial placement, which, you know, researchers have found is very important for, you know, your long-run earnings, things of that nature. So over your life cycle, how well you do in the labor market, that first job appears to be very important. So it might be worthwhile to look at whether the degrees, the particular majors, have an effect on that initial job. Now, we don't capture that, so I can't answer that question. Sure. But I can definitely say for your second job, our data suggests that what you majored in doesn't matter. The thing that mattered more was the internship experience and whether you got a sort of a, what we call adequate job or in-field employment versus underemployment. So if you became underemployed, that was after graduation, that was a very negative thing in terms of your subsequent job market opportunities.
You and your colleagues found that graduates with internship experience were 14% more likely to get an interview request. And these were internships that they hypothetically had 4 or 5 years prior.
Summer of 2009.
Sure.
So again, they graduated in May 2010. They did 25% of our applicants were randomly assigned an internship the summer before. So the summer of 2009, they worked in an internship that matched the job they were applying to. So if they were applying in marketing, 25% of those applicants were randomly assigned this internship in marketing for the summer of 2009. So if you think about that versus the major effects that I just spoke about, the major effects didn't matter 4 years down the road, but the internship was still paying off 4 to 5 years later and generating a higher interview rate.
I know you were looking at numbers, but do you have any sense as to why internships are so important to employers, even if it is 4 or 5 years down the line?
That's a really good question. And I think hindsight is 20/20. I think we could have figured out the answer to that question had we have been a little more forward-looking, perhaps. But the way to think about this is that the internship could signal a couple. It could be a signal. It could say, I'm a high-ability person. I got this internship. So maybe employers are just looking for some signal of ability. But it also could be that the internship gives that applicant some skills or some knowledge about the business world, and employers value that. Now, separating those two things out is really critical for policy, because if the internship is just a signal, it could sort of muddy the waters, so to speak, and make employers difficult to identify high and low ability job seekers. But if it actually results in people getting skills and knowledge that employers value, then that there's a potential role for the government to maybe incentivize firms to take on interns, maybe paid interns, which would address some of the legal battles that are taking place about unpaid internships.
And I wonder, too, if it signals to employers, I think you might have addressed this in the paper, that the recent graduate, the employee, is interested in that field and wants, yes, to consider and wants to continue working in that field.
I think
too.
That's plausible. You know, I worked as a banking intern in summer of 2009, and I'm trying to get another banking job, which, you know, like you say, might signal that I really want to work in banking, and then employers probably want someone who wants to work for them. I would add one thing to this, and I think this is an important point, is that the internships that we had, keep in mind that the applicant worked for a different firm as an intern in the summer of 2009, and they were applying to a different firm in 2013. A lot of internships, you work for a firm as an intern, and they end up hiring you. So we miss all of those. So this 14% interview rate differential that we find is likely larger.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Today, I'm talking with John Nunley. He's a UW La Crosse Assistant Professor of Economics who worked on research and trying to find out what employers are looking for in recent college graduates. And the companies that you sent these fake resumes to, you didn't end up talking with them in the end. If they emailed or called, you all just said, nope, we're done with the job search.
We swiftly responded. So as to, we're aware that there are some costs imposed on firms of doing this. So we want to try to minimize that cost and also minimize any effect on other job seekers. So as soon as we received an interview request or a call to talk about the position further, we called them back or emailed them back instantly and told them that we'd accepted another position.
So they didn't actually know they were part of this research?
No, they did not. Well, that's actually important because, you know, we want to see how the firms really behave. You know, if we surveyed a firm and said, do you discriminate against minorities? And even if you promised not to use that information against them, you still would have a high probability that some of them would lie to you and not admit that. Or it could be that they're not even aware that they're doing it. There's something in psychology called implicit discrimination, where you discriminate without even realizing that you're doing it. It's something that's sort of ingrained in you.
One of the other factors that you looked through this resume audit is the unemployment gaps and how that may or may not affect a college graduate receiving a callback for an interview. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so it turns out that there was really no relationship between unemployment spells and job opportunities, and that we had two different types of unemployment spells. Those that occurred right after you graduated, so you completed your degree and you couldn't find a job for 3, 6, or 12 months. Some people got a job and kept that job the entire time. Another portion of those applicants got the job, but then they lost the job at the time of application. So we actually look at sort of what we call front-end and back-end unemployment spells. So we believe that it's likely that employers probably expected to see some of that. Everybody knows that the unemployment rate's been high, but if you break it down by education category, you see very, very different levels of unemployment for different education groups. So, for example, if you look at all college graduates during this recession, you would see unemployment rates of about 4%. But if you look at recent college graduates, you'd see unemployment rates in excess of 10%, above the national rate at the trough of the recession. So recent college graduates have had a pretty tough time. And so it could be that employers have expected to see gaps in their work history, and they didn't treat them differently based on that.
And underemployment, so taking a job maybe as, I think you guys had barista, tutor, customer service representative, and sales associate. If someone had one of those positions, that also affected them getting an interview.
Well, actually, our underemployment was a retail job.
Oh, okay.
So like a salesperson in a retail store. I don't want to name the names of those firms that we use. And that was a pretty significant inhibitor to subsequent employment opportunities. About a 30% interview rate differential for those that became underemployed versus adequately employed.
If an employer knows that the job market is tough, and if applicant X has to do what they have to do to get by and picks up a job at, you know, this store that you've put on the resume, it's interesting that that would cause them harm.
With hindsight, we would have done slightly different with the design to tease that out. But we believe, and certainly it's consistent with other studies, that the underemployment, becoming underemployed, is likely some sort of signal. Like perhaps I'm a low-ability worker and I sorted into this underemployment-type job because of that. And so employers sort of stay away from those type of applicants. And again, we don't have a way to test that, but that's consistent with other studies and certainly could explain why we see such differential treatment based on underemployment status.
And I think, did you all want to look into maybe how an internship would protect a person from becoming underemployed too?
Or mitigate the effect of So you became underemployed. How did having an internship in your past mitigate that effect? Because it could be that you become underemployed because maybe you're low socioeconomic status and you had to take a job. Maybe you've got bills to pay. You don't have the luxury of remaining unemployed while you search for the job that you want or the ideal job. And so when we looked at that, we found that that internship cut that negative effect in about half. Not only does the internship help you get more opportunities, job opportunities, it also tends to mitigate the effect of a bad outcome, such as becoming underemployed.
And another factor that was listed on these fake resumes, and I want to be careful how I say this, but essentially you found that employers do not care about your grades.
That's right. So some of our applicants were randomly assigned a really high GPA. So they would, below their major, they would put GPA 3.9. And that didn't matter. And also another sort of credential from academics would be an honors distinction. That didn't matter either. Our suspicion, especially with the grades, is that there's been substantial grade inflation across universities. It's likely that that doesn't mean much to employers anymore.
I guess then one of the more troubling findings that you had through these series of research was regarding the racial discrimination.
That's right.
Can you explain what it is that you found and how exactly you all sort of determined that there was potential racial discrimination going on through all this?
The data are absolutely clear that black named applicants, those with distinctively African American sounding names, receive fewer interview requests. The source of that discrimination is really hard to pin down. Is it based on animus or racism, or is it based on the racially distinct name signaling something that the employers don't know? In economics, we call that statistical discrimination. The animus or racist-based type of discrimination is called taste-based discrimination in the economics literature. And it's really tough to pin down the source. But there is no doubt, the data are what they are, and there is substantial racial discrimination. And I think the troubling finding was that as you compared black and white named job seekers that had internship experience, that had in-field work experience, that had business degrees, that gap, that racial gap became larger. One would think that that would reduce some concerns about race signaling some unobservable. But it was just the opposite, that actually the racial gap became bigger. Now, I want to be clear, that doesn't mean that blacks should not get internship experience and in-field experience. Because our data also suggests that if you would compare a white-named applicant that had a business degree, that had an internship, that had in-field work experience, and you compared them to a black applicant with none of those things, the problem is worse. So it's just that the black applicant doesn't get as much return to those attributes as a white applicant.
And this experiment was conducted in a number of different large cities across the country. Mm-hmm. Was this widespread in each of those cities?
It's fairly robust across the cities. As you look within the cities, that it gets a little bit harder to conclude mm-hmm. based on statistical analysis because the sample sizes are getting smaller. But, I mean, there was consistently a black-white interview differential.
I mean, can something like that, you'd hope it'd be a reality check for different businesses or HR departments?
Oh, I think that's the hope. You know, there was a study done a few years ago by Joseph Price and Justin Wolfers that showed evidence of racial discrimination in the National Basketball Association. And their findings were widely publicized. They were on SportsCenter, all these different sports shows, and they reran their experiment or their analysis on more recent data, and the problem has gone away. Acknowledging that these types of things are going on can certainly help alleviate the problem. There's one other finding that I think is noteworthy about the racial discrimination, and we thought this was sort of the most interesting thing. When we broke the jobs down by whether the future job holders or the applicants, who they would interact with. Would they be interacting with customers? or would they be interacting with a team environment at work? And when we did that, we found that all of the discrimination that we had detected in other specifications was driven entirely in customer-related jobs. It's difficult to say exactly why that is. It could be that employers think that their customers would rather interact with a white person versus a black person, so they interview more whites relative to blacks. And there's also the statistical discrimination type explanations for that too, but basically all the discrimination against blacks that we detect is through that customer in customer-related jobs.
When all is said and done, I'm wondering if you could maybe shed some light on the job market and, you know, besides probably seeking an internship while in college, what other advice do you have for recent college graduates or soon-to-be college graduates who want to enter the field that they're studying?
Obtaining experience in that field, and that can be done, like you said, with an internship. You know, it may be, you know, I've wondered about this, and we didn't study this, but you know, when I was an undergrad, I worked as a bartender, and I largely did that because I would get paid more. And I've wondered if which everything worked out, I ended up getting my PhD and becoming a professor, which is what I want to do, obviously. But I wondered, you know, what if I had worked in a bank, maybe at a low-level job, maybe I don't make as much money, but maybe that helps me move my way up in the banking world if I wanted to work in banking. So I don't have any sort of experimental evidence supporting that, but I mean, the internship experience sort of suggests that that's probably something that students should do. I think anything that you can do as a student to help transition from school to work is probably a good investment for you to make. Because I think that as educators, it's very difficult for us to first know what skills or attributes that employers want. One, because employers are very different. They're going to do different. Every firm's going to, you could have two finance companies that are going to do things very differently. So it's really difficult for us to prepare you for exactly what they're going to want. So as a result, I think students have to try to get those labor market skills that are specific to what they want to do.
John Nunley is a UW La Crosse Assistant Professor of Economics. He worked on a series of studies looking at what employers are seeking in recent college graduates. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Coming up next, we'll talk about a new book that looks at the history of motherhood in the U.S. To hear audio archives of today's show, visit our website, wpr.org/newsmakers. There, you'll also find links to the research John Nunley and his colleagues did on the job market for recent graduates. Our site also has archives of other recent editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share comments or make a suggestion for future shows, you'll also find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. For updates on future shows, links to our archives and photos, like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Father's Day is Sunday, and that gives us an opportunity to acknowledge all our dads do for us. But just ahead of that, we want to revisit the role of our moms with an extended version of an interview we first shared last month on the history of motherhood. UW La Crosse Women's Studies and History professor Jody Vandenberg-Daves is the author of Modern Motherhood and American History. Wisconsin Public Radio's John Davis asked her why she wrote the book.
There was a need for this book, and I had a very strong, longstanding interest in it. I became a mother nearly 22 years ago, and I was already finishing my doctorate in women's history and, broadly speaking, social history. And I felt like this experience needed to be understood from a historical perspective. So I first taught the class at McAllister College when I was an adjunct professor there. And then when I came here in 1999, I developed it as part of my regular course rotation. And as I taught the class, I realized there were lots of little studies about aspects of motherhood, but there was no overarching history of the subject, even though there was there had been attempts to do kind of overarching histories of women in general. What really kind of made me realize the absence was when I saw a very good history of childhood by Stephen Mintz. And I thought, if he can do this for childhood, I bet it can be done for motherhood.
Now, your book is being marketed anyway as the first comprehensive history.
Yes.
Of motherhood in America. Why hasn't there been one written before?
I think one of the reasons has to do with the traditions of history. In other words, history started as a field about great men. And since the 1960s and 70s, we've had a lot more research into the lives of ordinary people, into women's history, feminist approaches to history. However, one of the things that animated that discussion back then was helping women get access to the public arenas to which they had long been denied access. For example, helping women have a broader place in the labor force, expand their access to higher education, get into politics. And so for a long time and still today, a lot of history of women is written about their struggles to get to access those areas, which is very important history and needs to be done. The history of private life, I think there is a little bit of a cultural bias that we, you know, that's just not really history. But I also think it's harder. You have to be very resourceful to find that history because the lives of mothers have often not been considered worthy of story or study. Mothers have been very busy and often have not been asked to sit down and talk about their experiences, have often not had time to write down those experiences. So sometimes you get glimpses of mothers' lives, even in what I did here, more than I would have liked. You have to go through the eyes of experts or people talking to mothers. There's still, I wish there was more. I've tried to do what I could with what historians have found. It's really a synthesis of many other people's work here as historians.
Your book starts with the formation of America, really. What was it like to be a mother at the time America was being formed?
It definitely depended on who you were. It depended on your class and race quite a bit, what it was like to be a mother, as it still does today in many respects. The Puritans would have a very long-lasting impact on our cultural norms about motherhood, so I do spend a fair amount of time with them. They had the idea that children were willful little beings who really needed a father's discipline. Fathers were considered the morally superior of the two parents, the important disciplinarians, spare the rod, spoil the child. You, even when you see Puritan children pictured in art, they look like full-grown adults, just miniature. Puritans even discouraged crawling. They wanted children to be upright as fast as possible and independent. And this is not maybe just entirely a Puritan thing. Children were valued for their labor, and they needed to be disciplined to be laborers in many parts of the world at that time. Of course, the situation was different for enslaved mothers, different for women who were in the southern colonies, many of whom came over as indentured servants. And if they got pregnant while they were indentured servants, they'd have to extend their term as indentured servants. So it really varied a lot, but I do spend a fair amount of time with the Puritans because one of their things, too, was that the father was the head of the family, and that women's labor as mothers and in general was less valued than it was in, say, native cultures or African cultures. And so that carried forward in American history, the idea that women's role is a secondary role. The Puritans called the wife the helpmeet. In other words, she helped her husband. So that kind of separation and somewhat devaluing of women's labor had an impact later on in American history.
There's a shift to something called moral motherhood, mm-hmm. or Republican with a small r.
Yes.
Could you talk about that, please?
A historian named Linda Kerber defined the term Republican motherhood with a small r, which was the idea in the early American Republic, right in the era of the American Revolution and afterwards, that mothers were the moral guardians of the nation. They would regard the new republic, which was you know, this great experiment in self-government for Americans. There were, you know, ideas flowing across the Atlantic about women having a little bit broader role in citizenship, but those ideas were squelched pretty quickly. And the idea was that women's role as citizens was to raise the next generation of male citizens. So they would teach their sons how to be moral and upright citizens. It's an interesting development because in some ways, it elevated women as reasonable and later even more sentimental and moral people. And some historians say part of the reason that ideology developed is that you had the rough and tumble world of commerce that was really heating up in this era. And men were sort of empowered to go out into that sphere while women would keep the hearth and they would keep the kind of moral center of the family. And by the 1830s, it's more this moral motherhood, which is much more religiously infused. It's a little bit less Protestant religious infusion. It's a little bit less about the new republic and a political role, and it's more privatized. It's more mothers. The language about mothers was extremely flowery and sentimental and very sacred. So a mother had to be more or less selfless and ideal as the role model for her child. And the new idea about children was they were innocent and they needed the guidance of a selfless, pious, you know, very feminine influence of the mother, that was a more important force now than the role of the father. And it makes sense if you see children as innocent beings that you would say, oh, they're going to be governed by inspiration of this beautiful feminine figure. And the child-rearing advice of that time period, I use it. I look at those documents with my students and they're kind of amazed, like never show anger, you know, those kinds of things. Meanwhile, the role of the fathers in raising children becomes de-emphasized in that time period. So that moral motherhood really invests women with this singular responsibility in terms of their children's character development. And when I go into the diary and letter evidence available at that time, of which there's a little bit more, but it's almost all white middle-class women. Still, what I find from that limited source base is what seems to be a growing self-consciousness about that role and more introspection about doing it right and the weighty responsibility of having that child's character development in your hands.
What was men's job when there was that shift?
You're seeing more of an elaboration of the idea of men as the breadwinners, and the Industrial Revolution is beginning, and there starts to be more of a separation of home and workplace. So in the colonies, most people, their home and work were one place. Mm-hmm. And as you start to see that separation, men who do leave the home for work are away from their families more during the day, and you start to see this language about the home as the haven, the place away from the workplace, which the mother keeps as this beautiful, perfect space. And you can imagine forward how that idea is still there in the 1950s with June Cleaver. It's a very long-standing idea.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and today, to some extent,
yeah. I mean, the domestic advice literature is directed at women today.
Right.
Who keeps the home? Who you know, who's in the Mr. Clean ads?
Right.
It's women. Yes.
Right.
Still the domestic housekeepers and ideology anyway.
There is also a very compelling chapter in the book that really deals with issues involving motherhood and slavery. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the significance that slavery had on motherhood.
I try to, for one thing, help modern readers understand what it would be like to be in a situation where your children could be sold away from you at any moment and where your authority with your children, and this was true for enslaved women as well as enslaved men, your authority over your children was not complete either because they could be told what to do by an owner. The vulnerability of African-American mothers in that situation is something I spend a fair amount of time on in the book. The reality of the enslaved mother coexists with this idea of moral motherhood and mothers keeping the hearth. And there's an incredible contradiction there that some people pick up on. And it drives the abolitionist movement to some extent. There is also, in the aftermath of slavery, the necessity of both parents to work among African Americans because of the amazing economic disenfranchisement that is still there. You know, the sharecropping system, the Jim Crow system, institutionalized racism in really very overwhelming forms meant that for African American women, the high rates of labor force participation would continue long after slavery. And so that idea of the stay-at-home mother was always much less accessible to African American women.
No matter what era you live in, really, things like family planning and reproductive rights, birth control, abortion, mm-hmm. always been a struggle for mothers for the most part. And could you talk a little bit about how those issues have been different at different times in our country?
Yeah, that wound up being a pretty big theme in the book. One of the things that probably a lot of people don't know is that in kind of pre-modern times, no one knew whether a woman was pregnant, except possibly the woman. there were a lot of conditions in which women might stop menstruating, but not necessarily know they were pregnant. There were no urine tests. Of course, there were no ultrasounds. You couldn't see into a woman's interior of a woman's body the way you can today. Mm-hmm. When women did not menstruate, sometimes they would do different things to restore menses, as they said. They would take potions for different kinds of herbs. And in the traditional view, a woman was not definitively pregnant until about 4.5 months of gestation. It was called quickening. And that was when fetal movements were felt. And so abortion, there were some criminal statutes about abortion in the colonies, but they mainly had to do with whether a woman was killed in the process of trying to perform an abortion. It was not criminalized generally before that 4.5 month period. But what happened in the 19th century is physicians developed a different view of when life began. Part of it was their studies of embryology, but they were also trying to establish themselves professionally. And they redefined in many ways when life begins and contributed very vocally to new laws that criminalized abortion. So that, along with that, went the politicization of birth control. Women had used, again, stuff in their gardens to try to regulate their reproduction. Throughout history, we know that people have regulated their reproduction in a whole variety of ways. If they had not done that, women would have many, many more babies than we see in the historical record. So we know they've always done that. But what changes is it becomes politicized in the mid to late 19th century, both abortion and birth control. And we see then in the early 20th century the crusade of Margaret Sanger to allow women contraceptive access to limit births. And the pushback she gets from that is remarkable. What is even more remarkable to me is that we're refighting those battles today. I never thought it would happen. Abortion, yes, that's been controversial for a very long time. But the idea that even birth control is becoming controversial. What's really interesting to read about in the early 20th century is the letters that were written to Margaret Sanger and also to the U.S. Children's Bureau, where it becomes clear that most of the women who were asking for birth control were already mothers and wanted to not have any more children because they knew they could not afford more babies. They were legitimately afraid of dying in childbirth or suffering debilitating health effects and of leaving behind motherless children. And that's what you see very often in the letters. And that the whole system that had been defined for American mothers that you're supposed to be supported by a man was particularly not working very well in the Great Depression. And even leading up to that, there were many families for whom that model never really worked. And so they would say, you know, my husband can't support our family in this situation. We need to not have any more babies. Today, women are using birth control still. The Guttmacher Institute has done studies on the use of birth control. And women, of course, their lives have changed a lot. Much more access to education and the labor force on their own terms. And birth control helps women achieve those goals by deciding when and whether they'll be a mother. Margaret Sanger said something to the effect that no woman can ever call herself free who can't decide when and whether she becomes a mother. And so, you know, here we are nearly 100 years after she opened the first birth control clinic, and we've gone back to debating that question.
Another issue that I think is a theme in the book is the issue of women in work, both inside and outside the home, and it really first pops up in the 19th century. But those are still issues that we're dealing with today.
Yeah. I mean, of course, women have always worked, and the work in the home has often been invisible. The nature of the work in the home changed a lot as the Industrial Revolution advanced, and then also the separation of home and work created a dilemma for women who worked outside the home. So we have this longstanding idea of the male breadwinner that kind of really gets amplified in the Industrial Revolution. And yet women kept needing to work. The male breadwinner model didn't work for people whose husbands didn't make enough money for them to stay home, or who were not married. We really see the strains on that. And I spent a lot of time on the period of the first several decades of the 20th century, and we really see those strains of women facing that male breadwinner model. What happens over the course of the 20th century is women just keep increasing their labor force participation, despite all the ideology telling them not to, despite all the suggestions that their children will suffer or that their husbands will suffer. There's interesting literature about that, you know, that it will emasculate men if women work and those kinds of things. Women knew they needed to work. What happens with the second wave of the feminist movement in particular is that women, because there's feminist activism, gain more potential to define the nature of that work on their own terms, to ask for more opportunities and better pay. And it's coming more slowly and unevenly, but hopefully some accommodations of caregiving, which benefit not just women, but anybody who has caregiving responsibilities.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio La Crosse. I'm John Davis. I'm talking with UW La Crosse Women's Studies and History Professor Jody Vandenberg-Daves. She's written a comprehensive history of motherhood in the United States. It's called Modern Motherhood in American History. The last 65 years or so, from the 1950s on, I would think are the most radical changes for mothers.
Pretty rapid.
Yeah.
Pretty rapid. Yeah. We see, you know, certainly there's some continuity as well. The moral motherhood idea seems to kind of get revived in many different ways. Maternal activism that we see a lot of in the progressive era, 1890 to 1920, has its new and really fascinating forms in the 60s and 70s. So we see some continuity there. The continuity that also that women are underrepresented in public policy, but change, so much demographic change and a fair amount of ideological challenges to some of these older motherhood ideals. So we're seeing in those last 65 years, for example, the stigma on single mothers vastly, vastly reduced. You no longer get kicked out of high school for being a single mother, or perhaps, as happened to many women in the 1950s, sent to a maternity home to deliver the baby in secret and never see it again. More than half of births to American women under 30 happen outside of marriage. That is a very, very significant change over time. We also see lesbian parents, gay parents. We see with our fraying safety net, particularly the last 20 years or so, I keep noticing these pieces of evidence that intergenerationally we're relying on one another a little bit more. The very private nuclear family ideal that emerged in the 19th century has never been fully workable for many Americans, and we're seeing a return, I think, to lots of different patterns of relying on one another, not just a husband and wife and two kids. So that's really changed. Mothers are working outside the home more and more, and they're going back to work when their children are younger. That's another kind of a pattern that you really see since the World War II era. So even in the 50s, we had a lot of women participating in the labor force, but oftentimes that was invisible because they worked part-time. They'd be home when the school bus got off. They worked when their children were ages 5 to 18. Now we're seeing many women returning to work before, you know, when their babies are quite young. And that pattern has been fairly continuous over time. So those are a few pieces of it.
Why do you think there are still a struggle in today's society with many of the themes in the book, be it, birth control and abortion, women in the workplace? We've seen a recent debate over why most women make less than men. There's a motherhood penalty in the workplace.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
If you're a mother, you're paid less than a woman who's not a mother.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess I'll start with the reproductive rights issue. Trying to be a little careful how I wade into this, but I think there is a lot of ambivalence about the rising role of women in the public world. And I think that the backlash against reproductive rights is partly a backlash against that, against women having public roles. We see that way back in the middle of the 19th century, that women, it's going to upset the whole social order of things. And I think with these rapid changes in women's lives and family lives, I sometimes feel like the abortion debate is sort of a stand-in debate for a lot of those other things. It gets so emotional because it's tied up with our ideas of womanhood and of families. Some of the research on this by some interesting historians and anthropologists suggests that women who oppose abortion, sometimes their reasoning is about you should just accept and make that sacrifice. The whole society is driven by these kind of consumer commercial values. Women who accept any pregnancy are being heroic. On the other side of that, of course, women who champion reproductive rights for women point out that to not give women those rights is profoundly disempowering in so many ways. Economically, the ability to leave relationships that might be abusive, in a sense that going back to Margaret Sanger, if you can't choose when and whether you become a mother, you have a lot less power in your life. And becoming a mother has a profound impact on women's lives. Feminists help women gain access to better opportunities in the workforce, but the traditional professional career path remains somewhat rigid and somewhat defined by the idea that you'd never have any interruptions in your career path. And when you had a situation where men could support an entire family, which was, not the norm for most people, but it was a little bit more the norm for more people in the 1950s, then it was a different situation. Women inherited these kinds of professional opportunities, but they didn't become very accommodating to caregiving. And I think part of the continuing ambivalence about working mothers, part of it is we're not putting the spotlight on working fathers. We have a working mother magazine. We don't have a working father magazine. There's still so much gender socialization that of course men will work. Of course it's part of being a man to support your family. But being a woman, that's a little bit less defined. And I think that we as Americans have lost so much leisure time in the last 30 or 40 years. And we often have two people working very hard and not doing much better than one person working very hard in the workplace a generation ago. And so we have a lot of families that are really tired and a lot of concern about how are we dealing with children and people who have needs. We used to assign that role to women. Now we've assigned it to often poorly paid women caregivers, in childcare, where we have subsidized education K-12, and to the extent that we have, and that's its own issue. But teachers there get a salary and are considered professionals. Childcare workers, like on this campus, we have amazing professionals who are childcare workers, and they are highly qualified. But we don't consider that something that we are going to subsidize, and therefore, childcare workers are usually paid not very well. And parents, on the other hand, usually can't afford to pay them very well. So we have a high turnover rate in many situations, not here, but in some situations we have a high turnover rate. Then there's a concern as a society, who's minding our children, who's minding our neighborhoods, who's caring for our elderly. Families are trying to do that on top of very long work weeks. And women are still doing that somewhat more in the aggregate on average than men are, both childcare and elder care. So a lot of women feel like, oh, I'm working now, but I'm still piling all these other things on. So the other thing is, because the workplace has not been more accommodating to caregiving, we have an attrition rate for women who might be seeking leadership opportunities. We don't have very good temporary off-ramps and then getting back on-ramps into workplace opportunities that could lead to leadership. And so our pay gap, our promotion gap, our leadership gap, even our gap in political representation all connect in some ways to these challenges of how we've defined the public sphere as for men who never interrupt their lives. They just go straight forward while the wife picks up the dry cleaning and takes care of the kids. And I know a lot of men don't live that way now, but that's how these things have been defined. And so it's far easier to access those opportunities if you don't have children. And that's why we're even seeing these studies showing that the pay gap has narrowed for women who don't have children, between women who don't have children and men. But for women who do have children, that gap is bigger.
Jody Vandenberg-Daves is a women's studies and history professor at UW-La Crosse. She's the author of the book Modern Motherhood and American History. She spoke with Wisconsin Public Radio's John Davis. Thanks for listening to Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCollum. Our production team includes John Gatto, Mary Meehan Strube, and our senior news editor and producer, John Davis. If you missed part of today's show, you can find the audio archive at WPR.org/newsmakers. Our site also has archives of other recent editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share comments or make a suggestion for a future show, you'll also find links to our producers and staff. That and more at WPR.org/newsmakers. For updates on future shows, links to our archives, and more, like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers.